Kuma wish, kuma wish.
You know, it's been over 200 years since the gold was discovered here.
It was against the law at that time to be Indian.
We're liable to destroy our own rivers and meadows. The same man that put us on reserves and ghettos. The same man that's on those dirty dollar bills that you praise. The same white collar ballers that be treating you like slaves.
Oh, great spirit, grandfather, grandmother, thank you for this beautiful red day you've given us, and thank you for our lives.
Good evening, my relatives, and welcome to Bay Native Circle here on KPFA 94.1 and KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. This is Janine Antoine, your host for this evening, June 16, 2026. Today, I have the pleasure and honor to speak with the producers of the soon-to-be-premiered 10-part documentary series titled People of the West. Executive producers Brad Manoa and Nico McGee, both Pechanga tribal members, have pulled together with the support of the Pechanga tribe, an incredibly talented film team, and Native authorities to create a complete and accurate accounting of the buried history of California's indigenous peoples. They join us here to talk about what the series encompasses, how it came to be, and their plans to launch the ambitious project. Hello, this is Janine Antoine with Bay Native Circle, and I am here today with Brad Manoa and Nico McGee to interview them about a production that they created called People of the West. So before we get started, I want to welcome them to the show. This is the first time they've been on the show, and ask them to introduce themselves to you, our listeners.
Sure. Thanks so much for having us. It's very nice to be connected to your audience. And Notun Brad Manoa Ka, Pinon Pechangawish, Pinokiam Pom Toshibo. Hello, everyone. My name is Brad Manoa. I'm from the Toshibo clan of the Pechanga Band in Temecula, California.
Miyuyam Natung Nico McGee Yaka, non Pechangawish. Hello, everyone. My name is Nico McGee, and I'm an enrolled member of the Pechanga Band of Indians. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you both here. It's actually quite thrilling for me. I stayed at Pechanga at Christmas time, I guess, and I saw in the hotel closed circuits. They had the film, the documentary called The Mountain That Weeps. And that was such a moving presentation for me. And I was so glad to see that it was being presented in the hotel rooms. And basically, for listeners that don't know, maybe you can tell them, Brad, what it was about, since you, I learned, produced it. And now you have moved on to this next production. But that was my introduction to you and to the creative process that you're involved in. So maybe you could
thanks so much. I'm so glad that film still has a little a life. You know, we made that back in 2018, and it's about the most contentious land use battle in Riverside County history. There was a mining company that wanted to mine our sacred mountain, which essentially is like our Garden of Eden area in our creation history. They wanted to mine it for aggregate for the next 75 years. And every 15 minutes, they would be dynamiting our sacred mountain to send aggregate up to there, down to San Diego. And the tribe was fighting it. The city was fighting it. The state was fighting it. And somehow this company was too powerful and kept moving forward despite all the opposition. So the film is all about that battle. And it's funny because after the film came out and we screened it here in Temecula for the city council and the tribe and other dignitaries, someone handed me a book called An American Genocide and said, this should be your next project. Oh. And I started reading it. And that's kind of where the idea for People of the West was born in that moment.
Okay. Well, you just gave me goosebumps right there.
So that was in 2018. It came out in
We finished it in 2018 and then November of 2018. Yeah.
And then you immediately launched into People of the West. Well, when I saw it, I was so impressed. I had no idea you were a tribal member. I just saw your name, both of your names, I think, on the film credits. Yeah. And called Mark Macaro and was very complimentary about the film. And it's so affirming and empowering. And I was just literally moved to tears by seeing that, even though it's some people would consider it a dry documentary, albeit inspiring, but, you know, some people are not into documentaries. But anyhow,
this one's interesting.
Yeah. When I found out that you were behind People of the West, it was very exciting, and I'm so happy that you're here today to tell us about it. So sure. Maybe we can just go on from there to tell us what is People of the West and how it came.
Yeah, so People of the West is a 10-part documentary series. It tells the history of California, but from the indigenous perspective. So we go back to the creation of the world, and we start there, and we take you through creation and how California, from the perspective of multiple different tribes, was created in the first place, and why these different landmarks and mountains and places are so sacred to us. And we take you through all these eras of time in 10 one-hour episodes until we get to the present day.
Okay. So,
and,
go ahead.
Yeah, if I could just expand a little bit. We made it with the intention of being entertainment, but also being educational. And someone, I don't know who coined the phrase, but they told me recently, it's edutainment. And that's really what this is. It's an edutainment piece that's meant to entertain you and also educate you. In October of 2021, California signed a law that mandates every high school student in the state takes an ethnic studies class as a graduation requirement. And that class is being offered right now, but it's going to be mandated in the 2029-2030 school year. And the state has a model curriculum that they're offering to educators, but in that curriculum, they ask educators to reach out to local tribes for more information, more curriculum, more history. And oftentimes, at least in our experience, when schools do that, tribes don't have the bandwidth to support everything that the schools need, because tribes are busy. We're doing all this other work related to NAGPRA and conservation and protecting sacred places and legislation. You know, our council's always in Sacramento or DC working on something. Mm-hmm. And it's just hard for people to find time to support education, but it's one of the most important needs in the state, especially for tribes. Our history has been pretty much erased from the public schools sort of record or telling of it with the curriculum. I grew up in the California school system. I grew up out here on a reservation, and in fourth grade in California, you're taught California history. And my version of that was one of the sugar cube mission dioramas. Are you familiar with those, Janine?
Yeah, the sugar-coated history.
Yeah, they literally sugarcoat the history. And we would take these sugar cubes to make, you know, the walls and build these missions. And that was how they taught California history when I was in fourth grade. It was sort of romanticized and idyllic and whitewashed. And the mission system.
I know you have
the mission era.
You have six children. Is it still being taught that way in the fourth grade?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So years later, my own kids were coming up through it being taught the same whitewashed version. My oldest was taken to a local mission on a field trip where they had to make adobe bricks as a fun craft activity and to take home as a keepsake. But for us, those missions are akin to like plantations in the South. This would be like taking kids in the South to a plantation and having them pick cotton to take home as a keepsake, when that was formerly done as slave labor and has a very troubled history. Mm-hmm. My second son was taken to a camp called Indian Hills, where they dress up like 49ers and they pan for gold and they teach about the gold rush over a 2-day field trip. But they didn't once talk about the apocalyptic nature of the gold rush for natives or the native perspective at all. And my youngest son, just recently, this was just a couple years ago, right next door to our tribe, there's a school called Helen Hunt Jackson Elementary. And they had a traveling field trip assembly where they came around to the schools with this time machine, and they were going to take the kids all throughout the eras of history. And in the first one, he has all the kids in the room close their eyes. And he picks a darker skinned girl from the crowd who comes up, and he has her put beads on, and he starts playing flute music, and he starts having her pantomime that she's rowing a canoe. And then he has everybody open their eyes, and he starts talking in kind of a movie trailer voice. He says, you know, long ago on this land, natives lived. And for an assembly that took 3.5 hours total, he spent about 2 minutes talking about the natives before European contact. And then he has that girl sit down, and he turns the time machine back on again. But next up is Junipero Serra. But then he turns into like a super fan of Junipero Serra and the missions and all the work that he did. And he's praising Junipero Serra as if he's a celebrity. But he's not talking about the dark history, the hard to know history of the mission era. But then he turns to the girl who played the native girl at the beginning, and he scolds her, and he says, now, at one point, you tried to burn his mission down. What do you have to say for yourself? And then the whole class started booing. She shrugged her shoulders, and she said, I don't know. And there was this terrible awkwardness. The guy said, that wasn't very nice of you now, was it? And there was this misalignment of the truth, what actually happened, and what was being taught at the schools. You know, he didn't go on to say why the natives fought back, why they resisted, why they burned the missions down. He didn't say, he didn't talk about the terrible mistreatment or torture or, you know, rape our ancestors. He just moved right on. And it seems to be that California wants its origin story to be the missions and the gold rush, but they want to sort of celebrate it and whitewash it. They don't want to reckon with it and deal with the hard truth. Well, that's where people of the West was born.
Yeah, it's probable that he didn't even know the history, because who does? I mean, most people don't know the history, and I'm not saying others aren't educated about what the true history is as well, which is what the whole point of your project is, the people of the West. So, you know, it's pretty needed. So
it's funny you say that, because, you know, we're on these social media channels now, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and one of the most common comments we get, people who comment on our posts, is that they're angry they were never taught this before. And how did they grow up in California, come up through the school system, and never know this stuff? And that's what we're trying to do, is fix that problem.
Mm-hmm. So you decided to get involved in the project, and how did Nico come in? Or when did you come in?
Nico, do you want to? So Brad came to me and he told us about the project. I think we were gearing up to really, after the two documentaries that we had worked on with our tribe, we wanted to do more narrative focus. We wanted to do projects from our perspective. And then Brad came up with this idea. And I think I was one of the first people to tell him he's crazy. And how are we going to do that?
And, oh no,
because
way.
I knew what it took. Like same as Brad, I grew up through the school system, and what we've always been taught is, as tribal members, when histories needs to be corrected, we teach it in our homes, and we teach it person by person. Nothing on a global scale. We don't want to cause any issues or anything like that, but we correct our own history. I grew up in the same school system, and my mom, she's like, if you're gonna make a mission, you're gonna do it the way, and that teacher better give you an A. This was in the 90s, and, you know, my mission, because somewhere on a floppy disk hidden in storage, but like, long story short, I guess my teacher gave me an A, and she was nice about it. Or to my daughter, I did the same thing, a different school system in a different county, and she got censored for it. She got reprimanded, and says, you can't make a mission like this. You can't show natives being treated this way. It's just a weird thing of, they're either hiding the truth by censoring it, or ignoring it completely, and it's so bad that, you know, people sometimes think we exist. You can have a road tripper that'll hit one casino that's part of one tribe out of all the federally recognized tribes in the state. They didn't even realize we were here, we exist. you can.
So when you
there's a need for this history.
When you educated your daughter, did she challenge her teacher, and was she reprimanded, or did they concur, or what was her reaction? What was the effect for her?
It was a personal thing, and you know, they said, we understand, but for like the rest of school and other students, we don't want to affect we don't want to offend anybody another way. And so luckily for us, we didn't fight against it. We ended up just moving schools because we were already ready to move, but that was like one of the last projects he had worked on before we came back home to Temecula. We had lived in another town for about a year.
One of the reasons, you know, my mom used to teach fourth grade, and she talked to me about the history that they were supposed to teach versus, you know, what the truth was. And one of the issues was the content being age appropriate. And that's tricky, because what does that mean exactly? You know, is the truth too hard for people to understand at fourth grade? And if it is there a way to explain it in an age appropriate way? And then add to that when they get to high school age and can better comprehend it. That was the opportunity that I saw with this ethnic studies class, that even though we may not be able to talk about some of the harder truths in fourth grade, we can at least lay the groundwork there and talk about the truth in an age appropriate way. And then in high school, when they're older and able to understand more complex history, we can get them again in the ethnic studies class. So we're not only did we make this series, Janine, but we also wrote a 155-page curriculum that we're giving to teachers, to every high school in the state, to teach this in their ethnic studies class. And we're currently adapting that same curriculum for fourth grade, so it's age appropriate and can be taught in the right way. And then the truth can be taught along at both levels.
The curriculum along with the screening of the docuseries?
Yeah, so teachers will have the option. They can show the series in its complete entirety in their classrooms. We've also curated clips from each episode, so teachers can show clips. We have 20 minutes worth of clips, 20 minutes worth of lecture, and 20 minutes worth of workbook, so that they can fit a whole lesson into one day. So you can teach this whole thing in a minimum of 10 days, or you can stretch it out to 4 to 6 weeks and really sink your teeth into it.
Wow, that's kind of brilliant, really, to separate it and segment it that way, so that as it becomes more quote unquote age appropriate, they can get the full story.
Exactly.
We're trying to make it so that there's no excuse not to use it.
Right.
Like it's just so easy. You can hand it to you guys. You can do it, and it's easily digestible.
This is Janine Antoine with Bay Native Circle, and we are here today, speakers of a 10-part docuseries that has yet to be released. Brad Manoa and Nico McGee are on the air with us to tell us about this whole exciting process and history about the people of the West. So we have come to the curriculum part, but we didn't really get into detail. I'm curious. I mean, the whole series is so well choreographed, you know, from the beginning to the end. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what that process is, not only the content, but how you, your concept of producing it, how you produced it.
Sure.
I don't know who's going to go with that.
Yeah, I'll jump in. It's an epic story, and I'll just tee it up, and then I'll let Nico sort of talk to you about how we structured it and how we put together the team. But one interesting thing is, this is back in October of 2022. I was made a fellow of the Native American Media Alliance. They were looking for unscripted projects from Native filmmakers to help develop and polish them. And they were going to give the opportunity to pitch different studios and executives at the end of that fellowship. And I brought People of the West to them. They helped me polish and fine tune my pitch deck. And then at the end, we got to pitch to different, you know, industry executives.
What process of development was the project by then?
This was in its very infant state. We didn't even have a script
Okay. Or
an outline. We had done a massive amount of research, and I just maybe a 20-page pitch deck with visuals and some quotes and some statistics just to try to sell it, you know,
okay,
to pitch it to somebody to invest in.
Okay.
And we went to CNN Films, and The executive at the time, you know, she thanked us after the pitch, but she said, I have to apologize. I was born and raised in California. I came up through the California school system. I didn't even know there were natives in California. We thought that all the Native Americans were from sort of the East and the Plains area. The history was missing so much. Her perspective, she didn't even know we existed at all. And we found that to be the case quite a bit. But well, they told us in that room.
That was my experience. I came here in 1973 from South Dakota, and I had no idea there were natives here or who they were. So
see?
Yep.
And at the time we thought, well, that's clearly an indication of why the series needs to be made. Mm-hmm. But for us, it doesn't meet our mandate. Right now we're interested in true crime stories. You know, mm-hmm. if a husband murders his wife or mm-hmm. vice versa,
right?
They're interested. But I was thinking in my head, this is 500 years of true crime. We don't follow a trend. Let's trailblaze. Let's put this out there and be the first of its kind ever. But they didn't see the vision. And we thought we were dead. That's when we brought it back to our tribe, present to them and see if they would be willing to fund it. And it was November of 2023 presented, and the tribe approved fund the whole thing. And then Nico and I were so excited, and that excitement almost instantly turned to fear and terror and dread, because now we're responsible. Tell this story. You can't just tell it, you have to tell it in the right, respectful way. Good way, so that it comes out into the world with the right energy and the right medicine around it. And we got to get every Native person in California, you know, on board. And I don't think I have to tell you how daunting it is, because Natives are naturally skeptical. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? What's in it for you? What's the agenda? You know?
Right.
And then,
right.
Yeah. So for the last, what, Nico, 2.5 years, we've been working on getting this thing out into the world. You want to tell them how we approached it, Nico?
I mean, we still are. I guess we'll go back to like the quick research, because it's just super important how we laid out our initial outline. Because when you start researching it, there's so much history that's involved for the entire state, and there's so many tribes that are involved. So Brad will talk more about it, about how this project and this show taken a life of its own, and it makes a way to make sure that its story is being told. So Brad mentioned that he had American genocide, and that kind of covers the American genocide portion and a certain amount of years from when California becomes a state, and the statistical nature of what happened in the northern and central areas of California.
So American genocide, you're talking about the book?
Yeah, correct.
The book. Okay.
That was handed to Brad. He had that. So this is where we split off, and we're going to start our research. I actually had a book in my personal library for a while, and that's called We Are the Land. I'd never gotten to it. And when we started doing it, I was like, let me check it out. Let me look at it. And that play for me, that one was co-written by Willie Bauer. He's a professor, and he's actually featured in our series. He's a master at history as well. And We Are the Land. And that kind of does the entire framework of California's history. Another one is Bad Indians fell into my lap. That one's by Debra Miranda. She's Esalen. Mm-hmm. And she covers all of missions up near Monterey Bay, like her personal history of missions. And that correlation with we are as Native people today. And one more, I would say,
there was also
California, a slave state. That one's another one I randomly found. I wasn't searching for it.
Who is that by?
Dean Felser.
A Native author?
No, I don't think she's Native. She's the only one that's one of the only ones that's non-Native of our authors. But that one I fell into, and that one's not just covering American genocide, but you know, did slavery even start in California? And it doesn't just cover Natives; it covers a lot of races. But she hit really well of like the indentured servitude portion and the lawmaking in California becomes a state and masks itself under free state title. So what does that even mean when you become a free state? You assume that free of slavery, it's a free state, all of that. But there's written laws in the state that kind of have a gray area where you can children and have indentured servitude. And, you know, you can just say they're orphans, so you can take them away from their families and raise them up in a non-Native household. So some of these books are what kind of started our research, along with oral tellings, cultural bearers, stories that people have shared on wax recordings,
written articles, all that had to be put into like a major outline. And then after that, we were gathering all of that. We cold called every federally recognized tribe in the state just to get started. Either let them know we're doing it, how they want to get involved. They're interested. This is what we're doing. This is what we're starting. And that was, yeah, a few years ago, back in 2024, early 2024, late 2023. That's kind of like what got us started on really creating the outline of the series and where we need to begin. We knew we needed to start with our creation histories and time immemorial, all the way at the beginning, and showing people how natives have always been here and lived here and where they come from.
Can I jump in super quick, Nico?
Yeah, jump in.
So, Janine, we had this massive amount of research, this outline, and we were starting to shape it and see how it could unfold over across 10 episodes. And at that same time, a colleague introduced me to a company called Boardwalk Pictures. And Boardwalk had just optioned an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about Richard Oakes, and not just the occupation of Alcatraz, but his murder, his trial, and how the murderer, you know, got away and was not held to justice. Wanted to tell that story, but they knew it wasn't theirs to tell, and they were looking for Native filmmakers and Native studios to partner with because they wanted to bring that story life. But right after that meeting, I had just finished with the Native American Media Alliance, and I just got the sort of verbal backing of the tribe that they were interested in supporting it. So I asked them if they would connect me to their production services department, and I pitched them the show People of the West to see if we could partner. As Boardwalk is one of the leading content creators in the unscripted world, which is what we call an industry like documentary, anything that's not scripted, you know, unscripted. And Boardwalk's one of the leading producers. You'll find their shows are usually in the top 10 on Netflix, Hulu, you know, Disney, HBO. And I thought, if we want to bring this into the world, it needs to be on that premium, prestigious level as the rest of the top tier content you'll see on any platform today. It needs to have the same respect and clout and production value as these other shows. So they were quick to get on board, and then Pechanga Studios and Boardwalk into a development phase, take all this research, assemble a team, the right team, to bring this into the world.
Okay.
So Nico, you want to talk about that, like the team and how we approach it from an industry perspective? I think it's pretty unique.
Yeah, I'd also like to talk about the series as well and the participants. So we have to kind of be mindful of our time.
Got it.
I can shift to, we can talk about, like, I can describe each episode really quickly on what we cover, each era.
Okay.
Okay, so about 10 episodes, they're 1 hour each, and it covers 500 years of history. And so the first episode is our first contact episode, and that's from time immemorial to first colonial contact. Second episode is the mission system and the true history of the missions. The third is the gold rush, and that's covering the end of the Mexican-American War to gold being discovered and manifest destiny. Fourth is California Indian genocide, and that's state-sanctioned genocide and also indentured servitude. Five is about reservations during the Northern and Southern California with Yosemite story and the Gara Revolt, and covering a little bit of the 17 unratified treaties in the state. Learn a little bit more about state parks. Six is on boarding schools, the survivors and descendants of boarding schools. They're telling their story and uncover the true history of boarding schools. Seven is resistance and identity, and that covers like the termination and relocation era. Eight is all dedicated to the occupation of Alcatraz. College students decide and go and occupy Alcatraz. And I think we're covering a lot of misinterpretations of how the occupation happened. So we have a whole episode dedicated to that one. Nine is all about the casino, starting with the Cabazon raid, and that sparks court battles all over for covering tribal sovereignty and the creation of IGRA. And 10 is like our most documentary-focused episode. There's no recreations, and everything is all about Native voices, historians talking about lived experience and what generations are doing today, land back, water back, fire back movements. And what we're doing today, what we've gotten accomplished, and what we look forward into the future.
That's a really beautiful episode, right?
Yeah, it's
like,
yes.
I'm glad you, like, we're hopeful.
I'm glad you included that. That's, like, essential to to see where we're at now and how we're going forward. I'm using the inclusive, I'm using the inclusive we, even though I'm not California native, because it is a similar experience all across the continent.
And you mentioned that, Janine, California is home to the largest population of Native people in the country. And they're California Native, and they're Natives from elsewhere who relocated for a number of reasons.
Right.
And in the state here, we're all relatives, you know, and it is a collective we. It's our voices together, and shows like this and series like the ones that we created. And when we all use our platforms and our voices collectively, that's how we get louder and insist that our ancestors are not forgotten. We should take a moment to acknowledge them and everything they went through, all the hard decisions that they had to make. Some people write about it as if they were passive observers of history. Our ancestors were all strategic decision makers. They were part of these intricate democracies. They had to decide whether they would fight in a way, join forces, and work with the colonizers. And they tried all different tactics throughout the whole colonization process. And it's still going on today. It's part of how we navigate it. But we should acknowledge that the ancestors just grinded through a hard, hard time to survive and exist, that we could all still be here today. And this series is a love letter to them, and it's dedicated to their honor.
That's beautiful. That's very important. So I'm wondering, you kind of, not kind of, but definitely touched on every historical period that affects Indigenous people in California. Who wrote the script, or how was it created?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts. We put together a writer's room, a team of writers. We found a list of all Native writers or Native descendants, people who already had the right sensibilities and foundational knowledge this era. So episode one that we're screening at our world premiere at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood on June 20th, that was written by Maya Rose Ditloff. She's a very talented writer, and she wove this beautiful sensibility throughout the series. One thing we do unique, I think, docuseries, is we go into full dramatic recreations. Most times, like you'll see on the History Channel, when they go to these recreations, actors are just pantomiming. They're not speaking. There's no dialogue. They're just sort of pantomiming, and voiceover is driving the story. But we go into full scripted, dialogue-driven stories to help viewers relate and connect with the people in our story. And Maya wrote the one episode, which is about encountering Cabrillo for the first time, the Kumeyaay people in San Diego. And in this history book, there's this short line that you'll read if you come across it. It'll say something like, these two Ipai boys were kidnapped, taken to New Spain as interpreters. And then it just moves on. I read that line. It hit me that those are someone's children. Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of that abduction, a mother must have been just devastated. What would it be like from her perspective? So we tried to weave in every episode a mother's perspective to show how it affected, how these murders affected mothers. Because, you know, in most cases, we all connect with and love and respect our mothers. And I just wanted perspective to be known so that everybody, Native and non-Native, when they watch, they'll connect with these stories, because they're real and personal. These weren't just people in textbooks in history. They were real with familial relationships, you know, loving mothers, husbands, fathers, sons, wives, daughters, relatives. And that's how we tried to approach it. But that's a long way of saying Maya wrote episode one.
Okay, well, how did you curate, or how did you find people to be involved in writing the scripts for all the different episodes?
It's funny. Nico mentioned earlier how this project has taken on a life of its own. We think we're driving it, but we hit this wall, or we hit some kind of obstacle, and some other window opens up, or some opportunity. And at the time, Boardwalk was helping us together, this team. It was right at a time when there's all this momentum. After Reservation Dogs, Rutherford Falls, the movie Prey, Spirit Rangers, you know, all this Native content. And so we started looking through the credits of all those and finding the people that were responsible for bringing those things to fruition. And we started reaching out to everybody. And the challenge we found is that not only do they have to be native, they have to be capable. And not only do they have to be native and capable, meaning they have the skills to do it, but they have to be available. Everybody was in such high demand that it was hard to find people available. Mm-hmm. Just started reaching out through their agents, through their managers, through them directly, direct messaging on Instagram, any way possible, our team would reach out. And we slowly assembled a team that, you know, it seemed like something greater, a greater force was helping us to assemble.
Well, the fact that you put over 20 hours, and that's the edited information of film together in, what, 2 years, is pretty amazing in itself.
It's the hardest thing we've ever done in our lives, and I would bet it'll be the hardest thing we ever do as far as our work as filmmakers is concerned. It was almost impossible, and somehow we pulled it off, and it's beautiful. I can't wait for the world to see it.
Oh, I think you guys are just beginning. you're creating it. You're creating a challenge for yourself that's going to go on well into the future, I'm sure. So, you know, I'm probably one of the few people at this point to have seen the full 10-part series because it hasn't been released yet. And I know you're planning on your world premiere next Saturday in LA. Yes. Hollywood. Welcome to Hollywood. So
interesting because we're premiering there, Hollywood, the industry that was responsible for so many stereotypes, some kind of poetic justice to bring this air, to bring it to the world there first.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that was really moving to me is to see it integrated with the kind of testimony almost of the different participants. So I was wondering if you could describe that process, maybe Nico could give us some information on that and how it came about, that how you conceptualize that integration. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think it just goes back with, you know, the series knew what it needed. And when we gathered all these people, we're just all on board and they all had their own piece of history that helped the series grow more. And you know, if you notice, like, as you guys watch the series, when it comes out, I'm not gonna say if, but when the world sees it, every expert has a different region of California that they're from. Their ancestral homelands are behind them. And that just speaks to the collaborative nature of everybody's telling our history. Everybody was on board. And the representation of natives in media is so important. It just has to be known on this global scale. And I think it was just really special to have all the different experts come telling their stories or their teachers or their cultural bearers. All of that just creates this nice, beautiful package. Like Brad said, it's just a love letter to California and our ancestors who fought for us.
Every expert, with a few exceptions, are natives from California. Yep. They're all like a mix of PhDs or cultural bearers or linguists or historians. It's amazing how they came together. And, you know, some people were skeptical and some people opted out. It wasn't just like everybody joined on board and was instantly a part of it. We had to make these relationships and build trust and show people this isn't a commercial venture. That was one of the first questions, is you guys are trying to get rich off of these stories. We had to constantly tell people this isn't a commercial venture. It's a philanthropic one that we want to give to the world so that we can learn our histories. We're not trying to make a profit. Any profit we do make, if ever, would be used to roll the message forward or bring to underserved communities or under-resourced tribes or to make new content to help tell more stories.
And I think it shows on screen there too, like not just native, but our non-native people. We had to have non-native characters. We had to have our bad guys. And every single one of them would get upset and knew how special this was and put all of their energy into it, all of their acting skills, and wanted to make sure that the history is told in the right way. Even with the writers, I mean, as Brad said, but you know, we went union, and that already shrinks down the native population that's working in the union today. And our five writers who are all native, it's their first time being in a writer's room together with all natives to write an entire series on this. Just stuff like that kept happening. And I think with with the representation of natives in media, I think we need to be mindful if there's any writers or filmmakers out there, let's try to get our hours and our credits to get in the union, because it's scarce out there. And it was really hard to find natives that are working in the union to create the show. It was good for us because what we had is just enough. It was enough what we had. We had just five writers. I think that was like the max amount. I mean, there's only a handful of them. And then, you know, showrunners, only one, and she was busy. She was already on a show.
What's a showrunner?
A showrunner is sort of like the captain in charge of the ship. It's the lead creative producer on a series. So a director is sort of that on a film, but on a series, you bring in directors, directs a certain pieces of certain episodes or in some case, full episodes. But the showrunner's one that's sort of thing to put it all together. So we had a master showrunner team that helped us structure it and put it together in a compelling way. And then we had a lead director, Chris Natani-Sigelski, who oversaw interviews and the dramatic recreations and brought that sensibility to it. And then Nico and I, with the showrunner and Chris and the directing team, all of us combined, we would ideate and brainstorm and discuss each shot and had to give our blessing before we would move on. You know, we were sort of the creative control behind it all. And that saying, because there was no censorship of studios or the industry. We heard often that when you get into bed with a Netflix or a Hulu, that these executives, the ones puppet mastering the whole show, and they're telling you what needs to be taken out, what needs to be put in, but that's all coming from a commercial perspective because they want to earn an ROI. Because of the nature of the way this thing was born, we didn't have anybody above us telling us what to take out. To say this, we didn't have any non-native studio heads of us telling us what to take out.
What's an ROI?
ROI stands for return on investment. Oh, so we're not trying to earn money here. They are trying to make money.
What did you say, Nico?
No, they're just in it for making money, and we're to tell the true history.
Okay. I'm not up with all the film jargon.
That's okay. I should explain.
I guess ROI is a big one for any production from their perspective. Well, for any perspective, I guess, but there are different
returns. That's what keeps it going. Right?
There are different returns other than just the financial ones. I mean,
exactly. See, you get it.
Yeah. Okay. So what was the most difficult episode for you to produce?
Oh, man. I think it's different for each person. For me personally.
This is Brad speaking.
This is Brad. My wife and I, we do have six children. But one of them sadly passed away when she was really young. In our episode two, we talk about how many children died in the missions. We depict seeing a child passes away and how careless the burials were. For me, opened up a lot of trauma and heartache and insight into what our ancestors went through long ago. But I remember of all the days my wife could have possibly visited the set, she happened to coincidentally come to set on the day that we were filming that scene. Mm. And we just had to like kind of stand off to the side and hold each other and deal with that history. It was a hard thing. And every day on set, we wanted to set the right tone and reverence and not have people treat these stories lightly. So we always opened with words to remind people to have the right headspace. And Nico kind of touched on it a little earlier, but everybody who worked on this film, cast and crew, they've been working industry, some cases for a couple of years and some cases for multiple decades. They all say the same thing. This is the most meaningful, important work that they've ever done in film, in television. And I think it's because of that reverence and respect that everybody had.
Well, I know losing a child is a very difficult thing. So I imagine that mission era episode must have been especially hard, especially if you weren't prepared for it when you came to see the screening or the taping or producing.
It hit her pretty hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Nico? What was your most difficult?
You know, for me, I've always been taught it my whole life, and I've always been around death and funerals, and it's always been normalized for me, and it's okay. And then I, even when I did the research, I got really desensitized. But I think when my wife reacted so heavily to Four, that became a hard one for me to really think about. And that's on the American genocide mm-hmm. and the indentured servitude of children. And that one is probably our most powerful. But, you know, she, all the way from filming it to even post-production, she would come and visit, and she couldn't even meet last minutes. My wife's Danae. She's worked in Southern California for her whole career and helped with all of the 14 tribes of Southern California. TANF, which is a program with helping kids and everything. Mm-hmm. And she knows so many families. A lot of us still carry the old names. And it's not in the series, but when we were doing the interview portion, they did a scrolling of all of these families that were affected and the names they came from. And all those names still carry down to today. And you know, it's just so heartbreaking for her. She knows children and issues that they may have. The intergenerational trauma, I think that one's really powerful in both ways. And, you know, if you're not ready for it, you're not ready to sit down and handle it, it could be really hard. I think Four was really hard. All of them except episode 10 were really hard for me, you know, production-wise. 10, I just had a great time because it was today. It was what people are doing today. It's people that are alive and what they hope for. And, you know, fathers passing knowledge down to their children, and they're all grown up and they're leading now. And just to jump onto what's my favorite, I think 10 is, like, you know, most positively my favorite.
Well, it's
so
got
like 5
a,
as well.
It's got a lot of positive in it. I mean,
yeah,
my husband always has started since the 250th birthday anniversary saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm 85. I'm almost a third of that 250 years. But you realize that this history is very new, very recent, and it's only a matter of a few generations that it covers.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
isn't that crazy? I think you and your husband, Janine, are the first ones ever binged the series. You know, we've sent it to other people, tribal members and family, and they can't just watch back to back. They need to take breaks. You and Dick, you guys just cruised right through and watched it. When he called me after, I was so moved because it takes a lot of commitment and effort to get through it. And I'm grateful to you guys for doing that because it gave us some new perspective. It's hard when you make these things and don't get to share with people. You don't know how it's going to be received or if it's working because you're too close to it. But that was.
Yeah. We wanted to. It was exciting to see the whole series, you know, episode by episode. So we did it like 2 hours at a time and quick. Well, plus we thought those passes you sent us were going to expire. So we wanted to see the whole thing before we lost the opportunity, lost the moment. But, you know, it's so amazing to just realize how little information is out there and how critically important this is and could be for future generations in schools or just even in terms of educating people about where they are. California people have no clue about the history that's they're sitting on, standing on, and the people, you know, historically, the people, what they've gone through. So I think,
you know, it's
what you're someone said recently. Incredible.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just, you sparked this memory. Multiple people have told us in the recent past that the only tribes they can name in California are gaming tribes because of the casino marketing. And how terrible is that?
I thought you were going to say the Navajo and the Sioux. They're not from here.
That's funny.
It's also true.
That's funny. It's also true. we hope to change that. You know, the gaming, the casinos, the resorts, those were hard fought for. Those didn't always exist. I hope people don't see those and think, oh, the natives, they're all fine now. They have casinos. We had to fight tooth and nails to get those legalized. And now the resources that those generate help us to preserve culture and language and to provide for tribes.
Plus there are many don't have tribes, the same resources. There are many tribes that don't have casinos, even in California.
Exactly.
That don't have federal recognition, that don't have anything really when you look at everything that they've lost.
Exactly. That's another key point we should bring up, that, you know, we did reach out to all the federally recognized tribes, but we also tried to include as many of the non-recognized tribes as we could, because their perspective, their voice, their history is crucial to understanding California history as well. So a lot of stories and experts come from those histories. Some of the comments on social are sort of critical, saying, what about, you know, them? What about the non-recognized tribes? But we didn't forget them either.
Mm-hmm.
You know how important those stories are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the most common questions. We only have a couple minutes left, so I was wondering, aside from the Hollywood screening, the premiere, what are your plans for distribution or for reaching people?
That's a great question. So first, we're trying to take it through a festival, a film festival circuit that will help get it everywhere in California. So we submitted to the San Diego International Film Festival. We want to screen it there. We submitted to Newport Beach, Santa Barbara. We want to bring it up to the Bay Area, San Jose and Carmel and Sacramento. And we've submitted to all these festivals all over California, hoping that we can take the series up and down and to every region, Palm Springs, you know, out east,
how do you
the
screen,
desert. And,
how do you screen a 10-part series in a festival?
That's a great question. I wish somebody was bold enough to screen all 10, but usually what they want is to screen one episode as the pilot.
Okay.
And let everybody else find the series after we pick it up through distribution. So we're trying to find mainstream distribution to get as wide a reach as possible, we're trying to attract, you know, a Hulu or Netflix or somebody to pick it up, a Nat Geo or History Channel or something. We're also doing the festival circuit, and we're also partnering with Picture Motion. They're an impact agency, and they're helping us get around all of California to have these sort of grassroots style screenings at multiple tribes and universities and schools. And so if anybody listening wants to have a screening in their area, can reach out to us through our contacts at Picture Motion. They can DM us on social. They can email me at brad@peopleofthewest.org. Nico@peopleofthewest.org.
Can you slow that down a little bit? Because people are going to write it down. Brad or Nico. And how do you spell that?
N-I-C-O.
Yeah.
N-I-C-O. At peopleofthewest.org. And that's also to get those screening passes as well. And you have a really excellent press packet. I was so impressed when I got this morning, and it details a lot of information, the whole series, the participants. So if people really want more information, is that available as well?
Yeah. And they can go to our website and, there's a form there to fill out.
peopleofthewest.org, I would assume.
Right.
Okay.
The best way to connect with us. Fill out a form that'll connect you to Picture Motion, to us. You can see all the episodes. We'll have trailers for each episode up there soon. That's where we'll provide the curriculum, all the educational resources. And, you know, follow us on social too, because we announce new screenings. We just had an encore screening get announced, because the world premiere sold out so quick. So now we have an encore screening Sunday, June 28th at 10 a.m. at the Chinese Theater as well. Mm-hmm. Anybody in the area could come get tickets. We'd love to bring it up to the Bay. We'd love to, episode 8 is a favorite amongst a lot of cast and crew, and that's all about civil rights, red power, the occupation of Alcatraz. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. And that's a perfect one to screen up there.
Okay.
Just reached out to Alcatraz themselves, screen on Alcatraz, but they wanted, it's between 10 and 15,000 to screen out there. And
what?
I think we can cancel that out. Yeah.
We'll have to work on that.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. I work with the Treaty Council, and they've been doing the event over there for, geez, I don't know how many years now, 40 some, quite a few years, but there have to be opportunities to do that. Anyhow, yeah, we're out of time. So I want to thank you both, Brad and Nico, for joining us today. This was an incredible session, hearing what you're doing. And I really look forward to seeing how you unfold this and I think it's going to be important that you consider some way of dealing with a lot of the trauma that this is going to unfold as well, because it is a very emotional film, a series. And
it's a good point.
I just want to thank you for coming on, and I look forward to your future work.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
It's so nice to be introduced to your audience and to connect with them, all the people at KPFA and Bay Native Circles. Thank you so much. Like Nico said, No Shun Lovik, that's how we say thank you. It literally means heart is good, made my heart feel good, and we appreciate it.
That's very nice. This is Janine Antoine, and you've been listening to Bay Native Circle with Brad Manoa and Nico McGee, signing off for now. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us to learn about the amazing new production, People of the West. The producers will have a premiere in Hollywood on June 20th, which is sold out, but they are adding additional screenings. More information is online at peopleofthewest.org. June 20th is also the date for the free 27th Annual Native Contemporary Arts Festival in San Francisco. For more information, go to ybgfestival.org. The YBG stands for Yerba Buena Gardens. Also on next week's horizon is Lakota Victory Day, also known as Battle of the Greasy Grass Day, which commemorates the historic June 25th, 1876 victory at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, where General George Custer's 7th Cavalry was defeated on the 150th birthday of this country, now celebrating its 250th birthday. I am Janine Antoine, producer for Bay Native Circle and your host for this evening. I'm sending big thanks to our engineer, Falcon Molina, and to Diane Williams for the opening prayer. Thanks also to our guests and you, our listening audience, for your continued support of KPFA and Bay Native Circle. We appreciate any and all donations, and we send a big shout out to our Lekshi, our uncle, Leonard Peltier, who is finally free. We also shout out to our many other brothers, sisters, and Two-Spirit relatives who are still living and still surviving on the inside, especially those on death row. We give thanks to our Creator, to our ancestors, and to the Indigenous peoples, especially the Lijian Ohlone, whose lands we occupy. And to those yet to come, we send blessings. Stay tuned now for Dead to the World.
American historian Manisha Sinha.
One could imagine the permanent achievement of interracial democracy and Black citizenship in this country. And if we had had that, you could really think about the republic that we had after the civil rights movement as having taken place 100 years prior. So it would have been a tremendous success for American democracy if indeed we had been able to preserve the results of the Civil War and create a society in the South that was more just towards people of African descent. You know, we still live with the long afterlives of slavery and racism in this country. And one of the reasons why we do that is precisely because Reconstruction was overthrown in a brutal manner.
Get learned only on KPFA. Bombay Stereo doesn't just perform, they ignite. And on June 21st, KPFA will be there, live from Stern Grove, capturing the explosion. From 1 to 6 p.m., hear Colombian cumbia, electronic rhythms, and a crowd ready to erupt. For nearly 8 decades, KPFA has been documenting the culture, music, and moments that define the Bay Area. This is one of them. the KPFA Stern Grove Summer Sessions, live June 21st, 1 to 6 p.m., only on 94.1 KPFA and KPFA.org.
You are listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, online everywhere at kpfa.org.